Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and looking forward to today's program because Ed Lyon is our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. Ed is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus, and it's always fun when he comes by to answer your questions. And I see we already have some callers online with questions. You may have one about your flowers or your trees or the vegetables. I hope you call in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Ed, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us again. What's going on at the gardens now? It's sort of a busy time, kind of getting ready for the season? Or?
It is busy. This time of year, the most that we can do is be cleaning up our beds. Obviously, any of the dead foliage that we didn't get cleaned up in the fall, we're doing now. Interestingly, though, at the gardens this year, we have two major construction projects. We have to take down and totally replace some of our walls, and then we're also replacing our irrigation system. So we actually have the wall project starting next week. We're trying to fast track that so it'll be done by Memorial Weekend. So, yeah, we're very busy right now with a multitude of projects.
Well, our lawn looks pretty crummy out there in our flower beds, and we need to get out in into our beds, too, and get things cleaned up.
Yep.
It's nice to have that winter interest, though, from the flower beds, but...
Yeah, this year we didn't get as much because some of those plants that we tell people to put in for the winter interest that will provide structure through through the winter were our ornamental grasses and similar plants. And that heavy snow we got this year...
Knocked it down.
Knocked them right down. So here, when we're telling everybody, oh, use these plants, they're going to provide winter interest. They didn't do much of it this year.
Jill in Madison has a question for you. So let's go to Jill. Hi, Jill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you today?
Just great.
Good. My question is, at the end of the fall season, you rake your yard and whatever the yard waste place you don't take to there, I put on my gardens, my vegetable gardens. And I was wondering, should I rake that up or should I turn it over in the dirt for mulch?
And you're talking predominantly leaves, I assume?
Yes, just leaves.
Yeah,
the leaves from the trees.
If you didn't shred those leaves last fall and you just put them on your vegetable garden whole, I would remove them from the vegetable garden and then put them through some type of shredder. Then you can add them back to your soil mix that you have in your vegetable garden, work it into the soil that's already there. But I would not leave them intact without shredding them as much as you can.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. They're certainly going to break down a lot faster if they're shredded. And
correct. And a lot of us use leaves like that as protection in our perennial beds.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll put down a good foot of leaves that will compact down. But as we head into April, then we have to start thinking about getting a layer of those off because they are going to prevent many of our minor bulbs and other plants from coming up through.
Let's turn to Bill in Elroy next. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I last spring I planted a couple of junipers, and this winter we had pretty deep snow up here, and the deer just totally stripped everything down. So I was wondering what I need to do to rejuvenate them.
Are you sure you have junipers or arborvitae? The deer don't.
Actually, okay. Actually, you're right. It's actually arborvitae. It said on the tag.
Yes.
I thought it was a juniper.
No, that's your white cedar, arborvitae, and the deer absolutely adore that plant. If they have chewed it down to where you have no green foliage left, that will not come back for you. If they chew into the green foliage and you see that there is some green foliage remaining, that could come back for you. But boy, if they get back too far into that plant where they go beyond what are viable buds, that foliage, it's actually leaves. It looks a little bit different on a conifer. All it is a modified leaf. If they get too far back in and they've literally taken any areas where they've literally taken off all of that green,
it's not coming back.
It's not going to come back for you.
Oh, Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's a favorite of deer and rabbits both.
If you plant again next year, you're probably going to have to fence those off.
Right.
One thing a friend of mine uses that seems to work extremely well is he buys the netting that you use to throw over apple trees and fruit trees.
Yeah.
And he wraps them in that. Now, a lot of people will tell you to wrap them in burlap, but if you literally wrap the plant in burlap, it's not going to get light to photosynthesize, which it needs to do. The netting allows the light to come through, and then if you get a good durable netting, it helps keep those deer from eating the foliage.
Good idea.
But one more question. Now, why is it that in the summertime they don't seem to be interested?
Because there are so many other things out there for them to eat. And they're being driven into your yards in the wintertime because there's so little else for them to eat anywhere else.
Yeah. So there you have it, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And we move on to Beverly in Laval. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I have a large area that has quite a bit of mulch on it, and I've been blessed with mushrooms. So I'm wondering if there's a way to take care of the mushrooms without having to absolutely remove all of that mulch.
The mushrooms that are growing on your mulch are fungi that are actually breaking down that mulch. They're aiding in turning that mulch into compost. I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, leaving them there is going to help in that decomposition. I'm not sure why you would need to remove them at this point anyway. You won't be doing any planting until probably about mid-May or so, so there's no real reason to disturb that area.
Well, the mulch is actually ornamental. The grass, it covers quite a bit of area that was once grass, and there's plants that are planted in it.
Correct, which are they'll come up and around those mushrooms. They're not going to disturb anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
And those are a good thing. One of the things when we see fungal issues on mulches like molds and anything that looks like it's moldy, a lot of people get concerned. They think it's going to affect their plant materials. These are specific to breaking down the mulch. They're not going to affect your plant materials in any way. Also, if you're looking to save mushrooms in order to eat them, thoroughly research whether they're edible or not, because not all of them will be edible.
Yep.
And so then one last question then. If I want to add mulch to it and put a new layer of mulch on, how long will it take for them to actually affect this new layer of mulch?
As soon as that mulch starts breaking down, what's going to happen with those mushrooms is they dry up. They're going to create literally millions and millions of little tiny spores. Those spores will then end up in the mulch and the new mulch, and then that just generates more mushrooms. They're only going to grow when conditions are ideal. The spores could be there for years and years, and they actually mature when they're under good, ideal, moist conditions when that mulch is breaking down.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill in Eagle, Wisconsin, emailed to say that he has a 10-year-old liquid bacillus thuringiensis. Was wondering if it would still be active enough to work on gypsy moth egg masses.
I would be concerned if it's 10 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a living ingredient that you have in that. So I would not be willing to risk that, the cost of buying the new product and then the assurance that you've got good quality material. I certainly would throw that out and get new.
Mary in Milwaukee. On to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm a fan. I've appreciated the work both of you have done, so thank you for that.
Sure.
We have a new home, and it's in a bit of a small subdevelopment, and we have dirt, and I need help on where and how to begin with our landscaping. The rear of the home is wooded with the accompanying wildlife, and I'd like to keep it as native as possible, as little lawn as possible.
Mm-hmm. There's a one help would be UW Extension. If you go to there's a landscape plantings that attract birds and wildlife, And that publication is available through the Learning Store with the University of Wisconsin Extension.
Yeah.
That's one a place you could just go online and get some help, Ed.
Yeah, you also have an exceptional nursery out in your area in Menominee Falls. It's called Johnson's Nursery.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Go online, look at their website. They've actually have a publication on their website that are plants that are native.
Uh-huh.
And certainly then you have a real good local source for those plants. And it's not done just as promotional materials for their nursery. It's an extremely well-written publication. And if you're looking at perennial-type plants, Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, also has their catalog alone has tremendously good information on native plants.
Yep. There you have it. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. We have Brian from Milwaukee, who'd like to plant some understory trees and shrubs in a shaded portion of the yard to create a kind of a mini woods. The area gets morning sun and then dense afternoon shade. Space measures 20 feet by 30 feet. Use this area for years to deposit our grass clippings and leaves.
Well, at least he's got the organic matter to start with, which is wonderful. And he's looking for suggestions of plants to do that with.
Yeah,
there's a very large amount of what we call the middle layer landscape tree, small-scale trees and shrubs. One of my favorites is a native plant here, Carpinus caroliniana, which is our musselwood or blue beech, nice small-scale tree. We could probably go on and on with any number of understory plants. Again, some of the resources we just talked about, Johnson's would have trees and shrubs, the extension publications again. A lot of people think they're extremely limited in those shady situations, and you're not.
They're not.
And you can go anywhere from native to some really fun ornamental plants that will stay small scale and tolerate those kinds of conditions for you.
Lori in Whitewater emailed, "My husband fishes a lot, and in the past I've buried the remains in the garden. Now I have a dog. I put the remains in 5-gallon buckets with a cup of sugar to help break it down. My plan is to later add water and pour. Is there anything I need to know beyond this about using a liquidized fish fertilizer?"
As far as I know, no. It sounds like a fish emulsion fertilizer. Many people will buy that and use on their gardens. It's a nice low-grade fertilizer. Again, really only use it on your plants that really do need fertility. Many of our plants, we tend to over-fertilize.
Right.
Many of our perennials, and we get too much fertility on them, they get leggy. And again, we're not forcing those root systems down deep because we're providing them with fertilizer right up near the top of the soil. But it's a nice low-grade fertilizer.
Absolutely. Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guest. Jim Packard, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question for our guest today, Ed Lyon, as we talk gardening, all things in the lawn and the flowers and the vegetables and the trees and shrub, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email at talk@wpr.org, and we'll do our best to get your question on the air. Mary in Fond du Lac, you are next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I was just wondering, we'll be moving soon, and I wanted to take some of the asparagus plants that we have. Are we able to dig that up at this time?
Yeah, it's probably actually a good time because we don't have the frost in the ground. The asparagus is dormant, so it probably is as good a time as any to dig it and take with you. Keep in mind, if it's an established bed, you're going to have some pretty extensive root systems in there, but you know, certainly worth the a chance to dig it and then take it with you now.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for calling. And Amy in Manitowoc says, "Several years ago, we received a cutting from my sister-in-law of a rose bush she thought was over 100 years old. It had been her grandmother's, and she lived a very long life and died many years ago. My sister-in-law's bush blooms beautifully every year with fragrant pink blossoms. Our bush grows, but has never bloomed. Any ideas? We've had it in our house for over 5 years. recently lost my sister-in-law, so it would mean a lot more if we could get that bush to bloom.
Yeah, without actually seeing it and your environmental and cultural conditions there, it's hard to say. The first thing, obviously, is you may not have it in enough sun. Roses truly love as much sun as you could possibly give them. The other thing is I don't know how that cutting was taken. It may not be that actual rose. It's another situation, too. Again, I kind of have to know, you know, where the cutting was taken, whether this was a grafted rose or not. If the cutting came from a growth from a rootstock where another rose had been grafted on, then you may have the rootstock rose and not the original rose. I'm a little suspicious that that might be the case.
Yeah.
If you look at the growth structure of both those roses, and not only is yours not blooming, but it looks different in the growth structure, that would be my first guess.
On to Carolyn in Minocqua. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
My question is, I would like to know what your feelings are on rubber mulch versus the traditional mulch.
Are you talking where they're now grinding up tires and things of that nature when you say rubber?
Correct.
Yeah, I think it's great for playgrounds.
Okay.
Does that explain how I feel about it?
You need
for
say points. No more.
Yeah. Right. Well, and just think about the fact that right now all these rubber tires we threw in the ocean to create barrier reefs, and now we're trying to yank them out as fast as we can because of what they're leaching into the ocean. I think that says a little bit of something what it might do to our soils with our plants. Use any kinds of mulches that are going to compost. Not only will they achieve the purpose that you want for water retention, weed control, and all these issues, but they're creating good soils for you as they break down as well. So wherever possible, always go with organic materials.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. Peggy in McHenry, Illinois, on to you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been talking with my daughter-in-law about doing a small vegetable garden, starting one. Neither one of us has ever really done that because I live in a condo, so they have a yard. So my thought was, though, that maybe we should, this first year, is create the beds, maybe do some natural composting versus try to plant the first year.
You can certainly plant the first year. One of the things we're going to have at the gardens this year to demonstrate how people can grow produce in small areas, we're going to do what's called square foot gardening. And you build a raised bed that's 4x4, and then you can divide that area down to 1x1 grids. And obviously, you can make them different sizes. That's just sort of the standard size. What we're discovering is we don't need the depth of soil that we used to think we needed in the past when we told people to do raised bed gardening. So if you build these, and there's a wonderful book right now, and make sure you get the latest edition because he has revised the book. His name is Mel Bartholomew, and it's called Square Foot Gardening. He's done a number of different television gardening shows. We're going to build our beds based on what he's done in his book. And he'll show you. You only need 6 inches. And if you're getting some good quality material from your local garden center or any site that's selling it, you certainly can start planting right away this year. The other thing to consider in your small spaces is using containers. You can do a lot of vegetables in a small space. Same theory as the raised beds. You're just doing them in containers. So you could be doing something at your condo in addition to your daughter doing it in the yard.
Mm-hmm. Could you give me the author's name again, please?
Bartholomew is his last name. I think it's Mel or Melvin Bartholomew.
And be
Thank
sure
you
to get
very much.
Yeah, and be sure to get the latest edition.
I may have gotten his name wrong. Somebody will correct me if I did.
Okay. Square foot gardening. If you Google that in, you're probably going to get it.
Nice, inexpensive paperback book. Well worth it.
Luba in Madison, on to you. Hi. Oh,
thank you. Hi. And good morning to each of you. This is the preceding program triggered this question, which has been festering and bothering me for years. But 25 years ago, or perhaps more, I read that you didn't plant edibles close to areas where you get car fumes and so forth, and that you should set back your garden a certain number of feet. Now, have you heard this, or do you have any information on it?
I have not heard it, I don't have information on it, but it certainly would make sense. I would think a lot of the toxins that are coming out of this type of situation could settle on your plant materials. I think it's like everything else. If you have a garden in that type of area, certainly wash your produce extremely well before you eat it. But yeah, I would certainly recommend, as far away from any type of exhaust that you could, that would make good logical sense.
Mm-hmm. All right, there you have it. And I just checked online in Square Foot Gardening at Amazon, Mel Bartholomew.
I did have it right.
You had it right. Let's go to Kathy in Racine next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a question. I'm wondering, up in northern Wisconsin, I have a small front yard, and I would like to plant wildflower seeds like the ones that are on the side of the highway up there. And I'm wondering if there's some place where I can get those, or if there's a trick to planting them. It's kind of a sandy soil area, but there's so, on the drive up, it's such a beautiful drive with the variety of the wildflowers. And I have a small, pretty small patch of a front yard that I just would love to dig up and just do that. And I'm wondering if you have any information for me.
I again, would highly, highly recommend Prairie Nursery in Westfield. Get a hold of their catalog. They are extremely good at showing people the proper procedure to get your wildflowers started. They do an excellent job as well as dividing out these wildflowers into different categories. Native plants that withstand clay soils, native sands for sandy soils. So you can get a mix, and they'll create mixes for these very specific type soils that will be adaptable to that type of soil. I tell people to usually try to avoid the canned mixes that you find at garden centers. First, they're putting a lot of annuals in there because you're not likely to get flowers that first year, and they know you're going to be disappointed. So you're paying for a lot of annual seed in addition to the perennials you'll end up with. And those mixes can be quite variable. There may even be plants that are native, but not necessarily the best plant for your site, either for durability, or they may end up being invasive, like the Missouri primrose.
Okay.
I learned that mistake myself the hard way.
Okay.
So go with a really good, reputable source like Prairie Nursery, and they can help you a great deal.
Great. Wonderful. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for calling. Melody emailed us from Madison wanting to plant a fruit tree in her front yard. They don't have a lot of space, so would need something self-pollinating and won't be big. She has been researching different types of plum trees and wonders if you have suggestions for her front yard.
Yeah, and I will not claim to be any expert on fruits. So I don't have suggestions for you for those particular varieties of plums to put in. But again, here's a great place where Extension is a wonderful resource. They'll have publications. Certainly, if you call your local Extension office, we have fruit and vegetable specialists here at UW and within the Extension system. So definitely, by all means, utilize your Extension service, and they can give you recommendations for your appropriate site.
Mm-hmm. And again, too, you can go to the Learning Store online, University of Wisconsin Extension Learning Store, and find some of those publications, too. Pat in Hixton, on to you now. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Well, I've got three maple trees that I planted about 5 years ago, and they've been doing real good. I've got two of them are doing real good, and I've got one where the trunk keeps splitting, and I've tried wrapping it and, trying to cover it with stuff or whatever, but for some reason it just continues to split, and it's not growing as good as the other two. I didn't know if what causes those trunks or to split like that?
It sounds like sun scald, and it sounds like you have one of the thin bark maples, like a sugar maple, and that is occurring in the winter. And maples are so thin barked, especially when they're young like that, that what happens, and this is a great time of year to actually see that happen, is that they'll heat up much warmer than they really like to be this time of year during the day. And then at night, they cool down quickly. And that literally cracks. And you'll probably notice that those cracks are happening on the sunny side of the trunk of that tree. So the best way to avoid that is when you plant them, and as they are young and developing the thickness of that bark, it's usually best to protect that bark with some kind of maybe a paper tape or one of the wraps that literally will expand as that tree grows. I tend to take it off in the summer because it's not necessary in the summer, and then maybe put back in the winter. The fact that you already have the damage, trees are amazing at how they heal themselves, but if this has been happening over the course of a couple of years and you really think that tree doesn't look very good, it's probably on the way to decline, and you probably will be replacing it as a result.
Okay.
It leaves out good. There's new branches every year. It's not been a problem from that. It's not at the same rapid growth as the other two.
Yeah, you've set it back each year, but as long as it's leafing out fully, like I said, the trees are pretty amazing at their healing process, and it probably has healed. So if it looks like this last year you were still getting that cracking and that scalding, then I would say you've got another year or two at least to protect them in the winter so they don't continue to do that.
All right. Does that pruning spray stuff work? Did you cover it with that one?
Most of the time, we tell people only when you're cutting oaks do we advise using the sealant at all. We have discovered that trees heal much quicker. When you're putting that tar or whatever the paint or base is, you're actually preventing that plant from healing as quickly as it would otherwise. Like I said, they're pretty amazing in their healing process, and they'll do that pretty quickly. The only time we recommend that is when we're cutting oaks in season, which we hope you're not doing. But if you have to, that does keep the insect that's vectoring oak will. From vectoring that. But otherwise, we tell people not to use those sealants.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. And we'll turn to Dubuque, Iowa next and talk to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was told that you could propagate lilacs in the fall by either cuttings or by cutting the bark and wrapping it right on the plant. Can you do that kind of stuff this time of the year?
I am not sure. I haven't tried that myself. You have a wonderful resource right there, the Bickelhoff Arboretum. You have a great director of horticulture there at the Bickelhoff. I always encourage people to use their local resources, visit their local public gardens. I would either contact the folks there or your local extension as well. Mm-hmm. On timing of propagating lilacs, I can't tell you for sure.
Okay.
Well, thanks anyway.
All right. Thank you for calling. Ellen and Suamico, we are on to you now. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I am planning some raised bed gardening for the summer, and I'm hoping you can help me with things like a workable size area. I'd like to do a mixture of flowers and vegetables, some of the traditional tomatoes, onions, green peppers, peas, beans, some variety lettuces, ornamental corn. Just questions about, like, the depth, the width, how do I protect my food from the deer?
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned before Square Foot Gardening by Mel Bartholomew. I would purchase the book. He lays it out so wonderfully for you, step by step. It shows you how you can make these raised beds. They don't have to be nearly as high as we used to think they had to be. He shows you how to grid it. He shows you how to protect from rodents. He shows you how to build very cheap and effective trellises. You'll be amazed. It's a relatively inexpensive book.
It's about $25.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
And it's well worth every penny, and he'll get you started.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Carolyn next in Manawa. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is I've got two Norway pines that have, they're only supposed to grow 4 to 5 feet tall, but mine have grown to be about 9 feet tall. And I was wondering, can I plant them outside?
Oh, you're talking about the, yeah. It's not a Norway pine, it's the, oh, the plant they've,
they've got the real feathery. Mm-hmm.
That is not, it is not hardy here no. in, no. Norfolk pine.
Norfolk.
And
oh,
they are,
Norfolk. Oh, okay.
Yes. And they're usually sold around Christmas time. They look sort of like a Christmas tree, okay. And they are not hardy to our winters here.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Probably not what you wanted to hear, Carolyn, but it's the truth. Judy and Delavan, on to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have two questions.
Okay.
How far back can I prune yews? They're like 30 years old. I've pruned them over the years, but I'd really like to take it down.
What we recommend to people is probably no more than 20% in a year's time, 20-25%. And so if you keep doing that every year, you'll be able to get some more control over them. Also, your standard rule on the yews is you don't want to, obviously on that interior, you're going to find branching with no foliage on it. Don't get back into that. Make sure that no matter how far you're cutting back, you are still cutting into green. Because if you cut back beyond that point, again, you will not have any foliage.
All right.
And you had a second question?
Hardy geranium. The leaves made it through the winter, look fine. Should I leave them or should I cut them off and let it come up from the root?
If they're green, just leave them alone. A lot of our perennials came through this year almost like they're evergreen, that snow cover that we had. A lot of plants where we might not have seen the green foliage we're seeing this year, they're perfectly fine. That's a good, robust plant. You won't have to do anything with it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Jessica in Clayton, Wisconsin, emailed in to say that they have some sedum growing in an area where there's poison ivy. Is there a safe way to move the sedum, and is there a control method to apply to the poison ivy this spring?
I guess I would again recommend contacting Extension for what are the current methods for removing the poison ivy. I actually did not have any allergies to it myself until I went and cut it, and I know that both the sap of the poison ivy as well as the foliage, if you get into any types of cuts, can affect people who are allergic to it. And not everybody is allergic to poison ivy, but this is probably a good time to get in there and dig out the sedum. As long as you're not disturbing that poison ivy, there's no foliage on that poison ivy, you shouldn't have any interaction with it. So I'd go in, get those sedums dug out now. I've noticed all of our sedums are popping up. You can mm-hmm. see the green. You'll know where they are. Get them out and then come back and control the poison ivy.
All right. Let's turn to Julie in Madison. Julie, hello.
Hi there. I have maybe a tricky question, I think. I live in Madison, pretty central, and like a lot of people, we have some chickens in our backyard, seven of them, which is a little over the limit. And
we won't tell.
I shouldn't have said that on the air. Anyway, we have seven chickens, and we have a problem because we don't have much of a yard, and what we've decided to do was to designate a portion of the yard between our house and our neighbor's house. Our neighbor, you know, generously opened up this space, and we put a fenced-in area, and it's a pretty shady space. And last year, we tried planting some grass and some ferns and some other things. The chickens completely destroyed it.
And they will.
So this year, we were thinking we'd try again and plant something that they can eat and that they'd get some nutrition from, but that would sustain itself somehow, keep coming back.
Unfortunately, I'm afraid if you're talking a really small area, what you're ending up here with an overpopulation of chickens, first off, you're going to have to, whatever you plant, you're going to want to let it really establish. But it really sounds to me like you got too small of an area. So if you're going to allow the chickens in there all the time, they're going to keep scratching and scratching because they just don't have that expanse of ground. And they're probably going to destroy most anything that you put in there. It's interesting, our ancestors used turkeys and ducks, and they'd actually have them go through gardens and fields, and they would pick off bugs without eating the plants and don't dig. Chickens are a little bit different. They'll just keep scratching away, and they're going to continue to scratch no matter what you put in there to find the bugs and things that are underneath those plants. I think basically you're going to have to separate them from anything that you do not want to end up looking like a chicken yard.
Right now, our side yard, which is about 20 by 20, you know, this is probably pretty small. Our backyard is maybe three times that size, and they've destroyed both our side yard and our backyard.
And they will.
It's full mud.
Yeah, and I used to raise chickens myself as a kid, and, you know, you get any kind of containment at all, they're just going to continue all summer long scratching until they have that whole area dug up.
So basically, there's no good solution.
Other than get rid of the chickens.
Yeah, or, you know, make a definite separation between chickens and what you want growing as yard.
So just assume they'll be eating bugs, but not really kind of count on them getting plant material.
Right. Unlike other poultry, they're after the bugs and insects and things that are in the soil. Mm-hmm. So they're literally going to dig up that soil. They're not just picking off insects that are on plant materials.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Garden, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening and stay with us. We've got a whole lot more to go here with Ed on the Ideas Network. Didn't expect to hear Gene Faraca there talking about chickens right after our conversation about chickens, but there you have it. Robert in West Salem up next. Hi, Robert. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Our maple tree split a few years ago, and a friend of ours said, drill a hole and put in a threaded rod with washers and nuts on each end. I've done that. And it seems like it's done it. That fixed it up pretty well.
Well, then yours has done more than just the bark split.
We didn't want to lose the tree. It was a pretty good split.
Yeah. What it sounds like to me, what yours did is you literally had branching that split down into the trunk.
Split just below the branch.
Yeah. I believe what our first caller was talking about is literally they look like slits that split in the bark itself in
the trunk.
In the trunk, yeah, and that's called sun scalding. That's a little bit differently. Another tree that tends to split in the way that you're referring to are the redbuds, and that's where you have branching that comes together. It's a weak junction, and then literally you get split right down through that's going into the interior of the tree, not just the bark.
We have a very large basswood tree at our farm, and it splits about an inch wide when it's real cold in the winter.
And that's sun scalding.
Yep.
It's been doing that for years, and it seems to recover every time.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Robert, for calling. Appreciate it. And you can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org as we talk gardening and trees and lawns here with our guest, Ed Lyon. Frank in Port Edwards, you're next. Hi, Frank.
Hi, guys. Listen, I have a question as to what your recommendation might be for a screening hedge. I need a screen between the patio and the street, maybe up to 5 or 6 feet high. I've had arborvitae there. The deer ate them. I planted yews, and the deer have damaged them so that they're about useless. It wouldn't have to be an evergreen, but I need something for a screening hedge there, and I wonder what ideas you might have.
Yeah, I would definitely go with junipers. The deer do not go after the junipers the same way they do the yews and the arborvitae. There's a number of columnar forms of those now that will take on more of that structure of an arborvitae. I happen to be very fond of the Juniperus virginiana because that is a native tree here. So obviously any time that we're using native plants, the cultivars of those natives are going to withstand our conditions. There's one that I've got in the gardens right now that I like a great deal called Blue Arrow, and it actually has a very blue color to the foliage, which is very decorative. There's also Chinese junipers, not native. That would be Juniperus chinensis. There's a number of cultivars of the Chinese juniper that would also be more in that columnar form as well. And again, the deer do not tend to bother them unless that's their only option at a point in time when they're very, very hungry.
Those plants maintain screen down to the ground?
Yes, as long as you do the proper spacing to begin with. One of the common mistakes people make is they want that instant screen, so they plant them too close. The plants start to grow in to each other. You end up with the foliage dying out then because they're competing for the sunlight. And once that foliage dies out, you end up with these dead branches, and that's when you want to come in and start cutting them out, and you don't have that. But you're not going to have an instant screen that first year. You're going to have to let them grow into their size. But if you do that, then they'll maintain their foliage all the way to the ground.
What spacing is that?
It depends on whichever particular cultivar you're purchasing. So wherever you go to make your purchase, find out, you know, they'll probably show you a number of choices. Find out what the ultimate size of those plants will be. And keep in mind, when you say you want them to only get to a certain size, that's all plants that are woody, that are trees, they're intended to keep growing. They don't just quit growing.
Oh, sure.
So you might, in order to keep to a certain size, there might be a certain amount of annual shearing that you'd be doing. But again, it's going to depend on which particular cultivar, the growth rate of that cultivar, you know, how you're going to space them out.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Frank. And Bill in De Pere, on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Some privets that are possibly 10 years old. They've always done very well, except last fall, some of the exterior leaves started to turn yellow, brownish yellow.
The first thing that would make me think that they're going to turn brownish yellow is they were dry. If it wasn't a drought issue, generally, they really don't get chlorotic. That's another yellowing issue in plant materials, and they generally don't require a lot of nitrogen. That would also make them yellow up. My first guess is they got fairly dry, so they yellowed up. I would think that that's not going to affect them this year at all. Watch them as they come out, see if they go into their normal green like they have every other year. If you start to see some yellowing, then I might think that there might be some nutrient deficiency. I guess I should also say that too much water could also make foliage turn yellow as well.
Yeah.
So if it's not a water issue being too much or too little, then it could be a nutrient deficiency. But privets don't take much in the way of nutrients. So I think it was probably a water issue that will be just fine this year.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for calling. Chris in Milwaukee emailed, has a snowball bush that succumbed to verticillium wilt. It had all the classic symptoms, is now dead. It was next to a preformed pond that we overflow during the summer to change out water for the goldfish in it. Did the extra water or might the extra water have had anything to do with verticillium wilt?
Verticillium stays in the soil around the plant that had it. But the fact is, verticillium is accentuated and expressed by excess moisture in the soil. You get the warmth, warm conditions, a lot of excess moisture. That's what's going to make those spores activate, and you'll end up with a disease. One of the other things I'd be a little bit concerned about is if you're flushing that water into this area that has the spores in it now, anywhere that this water then travels to, the limit to where that water is going to go, it is pulling those spores into additional areas. The verticillium was brought in somehow to that site, but you can now obviously spread it if you're flushing all this water into the area as well.
Would a quince bush, he was thinking of moving, Chris was thinking of moving a quince bush into that area vacated by the snowball bush. Would a quince bush succumb to verticillium?
I haven't looked to see offhand. There are a number of lists out there that will tell you verticillium susceptible plants. Quince, I don't know offhand. So I would certainly either go online and search for a list. I don't think they are, but I certainly, without the resources in front of me, I don't dare tell you. And many of your local garden centers and nurseries producing catalogs, verticillium is becoming a large enough issue in this area. Again, Cooperative Extension, they can tell you as well.
Let's turn to Jerry in Neillsville next. Jerry, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have really kind of two questions now that I think about it. I have several flowering trees like crabapple and cherry trees. They're the miniature. They've been in the ground for about 9 years. I also have some maple trees, a red and also a sugar maple. I've noticed that up in the branches there's a lot of moss growing up in there, as well as in some cases along the trunk. I just want to know if there's something I should do about that or if I should worry about it. That's the first question. The second question is I have three rather large rhododendrons that I planted. Unfortunately, they get a southern exposure, and in the wintertime, they burn pretty bad. I tried covering them up with burlap and whatnot, but I've decided that I want to move them. Would I trim the branches way back and then move them to a shady area? What would be your recommendation on that piece and moving those?
Okay. Let's address your first question first.
Okay. So we had the crab tree, the crabs and the cherries. Been there 9 years, did you say?
Yeah, that's correct. And there's, I know there's a lot of moss
yeah,
going up into the branches.
Don't worry at all about moss. And it may not be moss in particular. It's probably just a greening. It shouldn't be anything that's going to affect those trees at all. Probably most likely you're going to see it in more wet and moist conditions. And it's that's not doing anything to your trees. And keep in mind, we want to spray trees for every little thing that we see. But these trees have evolved to coexist with other things like mosses and lichens. And then your second question, this would be a good time to move those rhododendrons. Keep in mind, they just don't do real well in our Midwest conditions. We tend to be far too alkaline for them. That's why we don't see really good rhododendrons most anywhere. There's a reason for that. But if you're going to move them, it's a great time of year to move them. They're still in a dormant state. Again, our grounds are workable. I'd move them, get them right into the ground again immediately to minimize the shock. Do not cut anything off from them, however. That was the old rules we used to tell people, that when you were planting trees, that we cut them back because it was all that foliage that the root system was going to support. That is a fallacy. We want that plant to generate as many roots as possible. What makes it generate roots? It's called photosynthesis. So the more that we're cutting off the leaves of that plant, the less photosynthesis that plant can produce and the less roots it will generate. So you're actually helping it by transplanting it with as much foliage as you possibly can.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Doug and Shatek, we'll take your call now. Hi, Doug.
Okay, hi. Thank you. I have two questions. My first one is, I collect rainwater off my roof into 250-gallon drums. I water our plants and our flowers and two vegetable gardens. I read somewhere last year that they say the jury's out, but not. They're saying that you should not use water from an asphalt roof for a vegetable garden.
It's going to depend on what your roof components are. They do make underlayment for roofs that are non-treated, and there's also treated underlayment for roofs. And obviously there's some things probably in asphalt that might be leaching out as well. I wouldn't be concerned about the asphalt shingles. It's more whatever that underlayment is made of. I know many people collect rainwater off their roofs. I think most anything that you're going to find that's coming from the roofing materials is not something that a plant is going to take up and then put into its fruit. Again, it's a little outside of my area of expertise. Again, another area where you might want to check with Extension because, again, this is an organization that does a lot of research in these types of things and probably could give you a more accurate answer than I.
Okay. And then who is the author of that Square Foot Gardening?
Mel Bartholomew.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We've got Kathy in Waukesha. Hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a Austrian pine about 30 feet tall, and in this winter with that first snowstorm with all the snow and the rain and the ice that came with it, the branches were laden, and all of them came back except for one big branch in the middle. It didn't crack. It just drooped, and it never came back. Is there anything I can do about that?
Nothing you need to do. We noticed that Scotch pines were really hit hard. Also, our arborvitaes. And as long as it's not cracked or broken, it was held down. What it needs now is warmth for that sap to start flowing again. Even though you've noticed we've had some warm days, it's still not enough for the trees to be fully active and photosynthesizing and the sap running. You will find over time as we warm up, that branch will come back to its original position as the sap gets flowing.
And thank you very much for calling. Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, located on the UW-Madison campus. Great to have him back. Great to have you listening in. And lots of callers online, so I'm going to go right to the phones. And Viola in Shawnee has been waiting a while. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to get on. I have a question about my asparagus. I had bought some at the garden center, and it was plants. And they were very tightly grown together, and I just needed to get them in the ground. So I stuck them in the ground, and then my son moved them last year to a different place where they'd get more sun. Now, I'm wondering, and he just put them in there like they were planted. Now, I'm wondering, can I thin those out this year?
What I would do is I would dig them. Again, this is a good time of year to do that. And then take the clumps that you apparently have and try to separate them out into more individual plants. It might take a little bit of cutting. And again, you're going to want to do it as gently as you can, whatever, force is required to pull them apart. But starting out as gently as possible to get them apart so you're not doing a lot of damage. But remember, they're in a dormant state now. They're only going to just start being active as we get warmer weather, so it's a good time to do that.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep, thank you very much for calling. On to Eric in Madison next. Hi, Eric.
Hi, guys. I'm wondering if I burn some dead limbs from my black walnut tree, can I put the ashes in my garden without having to worry about the poison that plant or tree produces?
Yeah, there won't be any poison generated from that. And one of the things I'm quick to tell people, too, on black walnuts, you might have an idea of how toxic yours is. But keep in mind, Not all black walnuts have the same level of toxicity. They're individuals just like we are as people. Okay. So some black walnuts may produce a large amount of juglan. Others may produce very small quantities. I actually garden under two mature black walnuts, and I'm quite amazed at the plants that I have growing there. But when you burn that, you're also burning off the juglan.
Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Sandra in Madison emailed, has lots of ideas for her property, but she says, I don't have enough experience to know how they're going to turn out. Would like to hire maybe a landscape architect who would, for a fee, just evaluate my plans. Are there those types of people right here in Madison?
There are, but I'm not really sure whether we can actually recommend people. We can't. I will recommend a person for you, and I think she would appreciate it. And I will recommend this person because she's been instrumental in helping Allen Centennial Gardens as a volunteer ever since its inception 20 years ago. Her name is Tibby Light, T-I-B-I, and Light just as it sounds. L-I-G-H-T. She calls her business Fine Gardening. I don't have her telephone number, but she does have a website, so you could Google. She also has a number in the phone book, and that's what she does. She does more consulting. She'll come out and help you. She's not going to she does a certain amount of design build, but she's extremely good at that. And you'll find there's a number of other people in town who do as well.
All right. Let's go to Dale in Madison next. Dale, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to plant a pussy willow, and I have some cuttings from a friend, and I'm also, as we speak, bringing some cuttings back from Door County. So my question is, what's the best way to, do I root them and then plant them, and what's the best location in my yard?
Stick them in the ground.
Yeah, not much to do with that.
Pussy willows and willows are extremely easy. In fact, rather than rooting them in water, so many people start roots in water, whether it's a coleus or a pussy willow. Those roots are really actually aren't as strong as if you start them in some form of soil. So you can either start them indoors in a pot with some soil around them and then transplant them later in the year. I think you'll find if you just take those branches and shove them in the ground, they'll root themselves as well. Ideal conditions for pussy willows is they want fairly moist soils. You'll notice where they grow naturally are in sort of these marshy, swampy areas. But again, this time of year is when we're getting all of our moisture. So most any place you start them in your yard, they'll probably do fairly well as long as we continue in with a moist spring and they don't dry out.
All right. Thank you. I killed them last year, so I'm trying again this year.
And okay. If you did kill them, it's probably the most likely reason for that is the roots dried out as they were trying to develop. And if that was your situation, then what I would recommend is maybe getting, you know, like a gallon, 2 gallon nursery container, some nice media, soil mix, and start them in that and then transplant them later. And you'll probably be more assured of success.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling and talking about watering. Jesse in Deer Park emailed in, planted trees last fall, some oaks, maples, redbuds, pine trees, lots of trees. Should I be watering them yet?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the general rules of thumb, and this is why so many of the larger trees that we put into the ground fail, they measure the size of a trunk of a tree in something called a caliper. And when you buy that tree, they'll say, especially if you've got larger and particularly like bald and burlap trees, they'll say you might have an inch caliper, an inch and a half caliper, a 2-inch caliper. And that determines the size. For every inch of caliper you have in a tree, it needs to be supplemental watered in a whole year. So that's why you see so many of these trees planted in medians and areas like that. They might go in as a 3-inch caliper tree. They water them that first year and don't supplement water them afterward. So again, it's going to depend somewhat on the size of the tree you're putting in. It's going to depend on the soils that you're putting them in. If you have dry soils, they're going to want additional additional watering. It also depends on the year. If we happen to go into a dry year, you certainly want to. The one plant in our yard we tend to forget about are our trees. And we go through drought periods and we think, oh, trees that are established don't need that watering. You have to keep in mind that 75% of the root system of any tree is in the top 6 inches of the soil. They need attention through dry periods just like any other plant that you have out there.
Anthony in Kenosha, on to you. Hi, Anthony.
How are you doing?
Good.
Good. I have a really bad problem with Canadian thistle.
Oh, boy.
Oh, Canada thistle.
You know, my garden's been great for the last 10 years, weed-free, and about 2 years ago we got some mulch, and I believe that's where it came from.
And not even necessarily blaming the mulch. A thistle seed can travel a long distance through the air. It might have even come from a whole different area. And then, of course, once they start establishing and seeding, then they become an enormous issue.
So you'd like to get rid of them?
Yes, I would.
Yeah. Oh, well, are you digging them out and trying to get down as far as you can on that enormously long taproot? That's the most organic method to do it.
Yeah.
There are some chemicals that you can purchase. I usually try to avoid chemicals wherever possible, but certainly when you get a stand of Canadian thistle, that can be an issue. Again, I would direct you to Extension and some of their resources and what they would recommend for the appropriate chemical if you're going to do it herbicidally. Keep in mind, and this is something, and I hate to say this, I'm a man myself. It tends to be a male problem. We all tend to think that if a certain recommendation for the application is good, then a higher concentration is even better. Keep in mind, these formulations were put together because that was the most effective formulation for control. So when you go beyond that, all you're doing is poisoning the soil, and you may be creating a formulation that doesn't even work. So whatever application you're using, follow those guidelines and do not change from what that research has shown you. Believe me, if more will do a more effective job, they're certainly going to tell you to go with a heavier concentration. They make money on that.
All right. Thank you again for calling. And Betty in New Berlin, I think, has the first Creeping Charlie question of the year.
Oh, well, it's out and early. And
Hi, Betty.
It was evergreen this year.
Betty, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. How can we help?
Well, I've got Creeping Charlie in my yard, and it's overtaking the whole yard, the flower beds. We've used a special rake to rake it out, and we just can't get rid of it. It's all in the grass and the flower beds, and it's overtaking. I don't know how to get rid of it.
Yeah, again, Creeping Charlie, once it establishes, is very difficult to get rid of. Any place that it puts down a little bit of root system, which it will do the entire length of where it's spreading out to, you can pull that plant away, but the remaining root system that you didn't get will just generate more plant. Again, it sounds like you've got a really bad problem, so you may have to go herbicidal. Again, I don't recommend specific products. I let you go and wherever you're purchasing your products, get their recommendations, use Cooperative Extension. I'm not a big advocate of chemical use myself. If you want to do it organically, it sounds to me like you've got it in your lawn and in your flower beds. I mean, you can certainly try such things as black plastic, but those areas, you're going to be out of commission and not gardening in those areas until you accomplish that goal.
One of the things that you can do, at least in your lawn, is to promote good lawn growth and cut your lawn high.
Much higher. Yes.
Much higher. And that will certainly have some impact, although my 6-year-old daughter and I were out in the lawn last year. We actually spent a few pleasant afternoons pulling Creeping Charlie out of the lawn grass, and it is no. It was kind of fun because we sat and chatted. And,
right. It's like I said, it's very viney. It comes out easily, mm-hmm. but it just it's spreading, and it actually ruins the grass. It kills it, and we've had it sprayed maybe 3 years ago from a company, but that didn't do anything.
I have a friend who actually got so mad about it, killed his entire lawn.
Uh-huh.
And got a horticulturist in, replanted, and then the thought the Creeping Charlie was all over.
Uh-huh.
And the Creeping Charlie came back.
Really?
And so it came back anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got to tell you that it can be a real losing proposition. When they do talk about controlling Creeping Charlie, one of the things that they talk about is there are two times of the year to control it.
Mm-hmm.
One time of the year is when they when it first flowers. If you're going to use a chemical on it, the first time when the Creeping Charlie flowers, that's one time to do it. The other time to do it is in the fall, just after the first frost.
Okay.
The first light frost.
Mm-hmm.
And you use the chemicals that are recommended for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll look like nothing happened. But if you get the right kind of winter, what you're doing is you're weakening that plant. And when you weaken that plant, you can winter kill it. And so the two times of the year are in the spring when it's when you see those purple flowers out there, because then that's when it's growing actively.
Mm-hmm.
And then again in the fall, right after that first frost, you get a warm day. Right after the first frost, then apply it again then. And you can do a lot of damage to it. And I have had people tell me that they have actually been able to completely eliminate Creeping Charlie for at least 1 year.
Like I said, we've almost got an acre of land here, and it's really, really out of control.
You might also have some mold damage. And one of the things, somebody emailed me the other day and asked me about a trick that we recommended here on the radio show about controlling moles. And I thought I'd mention that while we're at it here. Moles, as you know, you'll see these tunnels, and they'll be raised tunnels in your lawn, in your yard area. And what you need to do, or what can be done at least, and it's very environmentally friendly, is to get some bacon, and you get a rat trap, and you get a basket. And when you find a tunnel that's active, you need to poke a hole in that tunnel, and then you put the rat trap and you put some bacon grease by the on the little catch for the rat trap, the bait part, and put the rat, set it, put it next to the hole that you opened in the tunnel, and then you cover the whole thing with a basket. And that keeps the birds out, but it also creates a black or a darkened situation. The moles come along the tunnel. They smell the bacon fat, and they come up and take a bite, and that's the end of the mole, because the rat trap will nail the mole. And if you, I know that people have had pretty good success. One fellow actually got nine moles. Nine moles on a lawn would be a considerable number of moles. Usually one or two can create a lot of problems, but he was able to get nine moles out of his lawn. With that particular method. So if you have those tunnels, that's the thing to do. If you see those tunnels, get yourself a rat trap and a basket.
Okay.
And some bacon.
Okay. Sounds good. Sounds good, because I look at my lawn and I look at other people's lawns and I'm like, oh, gosh, I wish I had their beautiful grass.
Well, do you ever fertilize your lawn?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Not that often like we should, but once in a great, great while, so I'm probably doing the wrong techniques that I should be doing.
If you're going to fertilize the lawn, the best time to fertilize the lawn, if you're only going to do it once in a year, probably the best time is the fall fertilization, where that's when the trees are the leave the plant leaves of the grass
mm-hmm.
They're putting their energy into their root system, and so what you're doing is you're strengthening that root system. Mm-hmm. In the spring, when people do it in the spring, all they do is they get a lot of growth.
Right.
And you just mow longer.
Right.
But be sure to also mow higher. People mow too close and think that that's going to that means they're not going to have to mow as often. Well, frankly, if you mow higher, you're going to mow at about the same rate anyway, and then you're going to keep out the creeping Charlie and the dandelions and the other types of weeds.
Right. That's what we tried to do, keep it higher. We tried that, too, to keep, like you said, the creeping Charlie and the dandelions, you know, the weeds, to smother them.
Yeah.
And it seemed to work for a while, but then, once again, it took right over, just went crazy, so...
Well, you might take a look too. Extension has a publication on lawn care that is a pretty good one, and you can get that by going online to the Learning Store at University of Wisconsin Extension Learning Store, and they can help you out there. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Patty in Stone Lake next. Patty, hi.
Hi, guys. Great show as always.
Thank you.
I listened to your answer about thinning asparagus, and we've grown asparagus for many years, and, you know, every few years I'll start a new bed, and about 5 years ago I started one, and it was doing great. We were harvesting really nice-sized spears, and then last year it just... All these little tiny ones came up. I mean, if you cut it, it would look like a lawn. I mean, I've never seen all those little tiny new ones. I mean, is it realistic to think I can actually thin those and replant them or just give them away? I have to do something, right?
Yeah, being that small and that new, those might be a little harder to separate. What the other woman we were having her do, they were all the same size, and she was separating them out so she'd end up with more ultimate plants.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a lot of experience with, you know, the little small offshoots like that. I'm almost wondering if you were to separate them off, if your best bet is to find a spot with some really nice loamy soil, sort of like a starting bed, mm-hmm. and then put them in that bed, make sure that you're keeping them extremely moist, and maybe even start them that way.
Oh, okay.
There
and
you
then
have,
thin yeah. them like the next year or something.
Yeah, yes. and then once you take them out of that sort of that little propagating bed that you've created, then as they become larger plants, move them over into your asparagus bed or vegetable garden.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Before I forget, we've been talking about square foot gardening, and Ed mentioned the book Square Foot Gardening by Mel Bartholomew, and the latest edition of it is called All New Square Foot Gardening, and that's the one that you're recommending, right?
Exactly. It's new, and he will even tell you in the book, in the introduction, that he has changed a lot of his philosophies and how he tells people to do this. So you do want to get his latest edition, which we discovered is called The All New. So do make sure you get that one. I think that was put out within the last year or so.
And for the woman who wants to transplant sedum that's in a poison ivy bed, we had an email from Louise who said the poison ivy roots will give you the poison ivy like the leaves will do. So don't handle anything in that bed with bare hands and protect the rest of your body, because if the sap squirts on you, you'll be in danger too, 3 exclamation points, from someone who knows, at all capital letters and 3 exclamation points. So
good advice. And when working around any of those kinds of plant materials, it's good to make sure you have on long pants, boots, at least some type of vinyl or latex glove. Again, protect yourself from any of that sap that you might get on you.
And Ed, you have a website, don't you, for the Allen Centennial Gardens?
We do. It's an extremely long HTML because we go through the university and the horticulture department. But I tell people, all you have to do is Google Allen Centennial Gardens. It'll be the very first thing that will come up because we're the one and only. It's actually easier than if I gave you the really extremely long URL.
Ed, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
Ed Lyon is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens located on the UW-Madison campus. Take a look at the website. Just go to Allen Centennial Gardens and you'll find it. And I really appreciate him being with us today. And certainly, hopefully, we can entice him back and have him do this again. Just to take a look ahead, Monday, Dustin Maher comes back to talk with us about staying fit and getting fit. And our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, join us to talk climate and weather. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.